Welcome to Sports Mad Rez's This Week in Review podcast, where we highlight the recent news in sports medicine research. This past week, we had two posts on sportsmedrez.org. That's res.org. The first post described a study where the authors reported that an early anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction fails to provide improved quality of life years and costs compared with people who are provided an optional delayed reconstruction treatment strategy. The second post was about a study where the authors found that a novel clinical risk score developed for the acutely concussed pediatric population has a modest ability to discriminate between those at low, medium, or high risk for persistent post-concussion symptoms at 28 days. This week, I invited back Dr. Jane McDevitt from East Stroudsburg University, who is a regular contributor to sportsmedrez.org and who does research examining genetics and concussions, to discuss this study with me.
Welcome, Jane. It's a pleasure to have you here this week.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if you could give us a brief overview of the article you wrote about persistent post-concussion symptoms and the predictive model they did.
So the group of authors wanted to look at if they could determine a clinical risk score for persistent post-concussion syndrome among children with acute concussion into the emergency department. So basically, they took the Zurich Convention consensus and defined concussion pretty standard. However, it's not concussion how maybe athletic trainers would definitively define concussion, because they did take concussions from assaults, motor vehicle accidents, falls. So it was maybe a little bit more of a wider range of athletes. And they determined numerous variables such as mechanism of injury, sport, use of medications, age, sex, number of previous concussions, learning disabilities, migraine history, and so on. And they compiled this into two main groups, a derivation group of 2,006 patients and a validation cohort of 1,057 patients. And they found that there were 9 factors that can predict persistent post-concussion symptoms among children. These were being a female, age of 13 or older, having a diagnosed history of migraines, concussion symptoms lasting longer than 1 week, specific concussion symptoms such as headache, sensitivity to noise, fatigue, and then several other things such as answering questions slowly and 4 more errors specifically on the tandem stance during the balance error scoring system. And then they broke it down into 3 components. If you scored a 0 or only had problems with maybe 1 or 2 of these, that was low risk. If you scored a 6 to 9 and it was basically yes, no, you had this or you didn't. So basically, scoring a 6 to 9 was medium risk, and definitely having these, almost all of these factors was with a score of 10 to 12 was a high risk for persistent post-concussion symptoms. And they defined persistent post-concussion symptoms as taking 28 days to recover. So their last data collection was at 28 days. So if they hadn't recovered within 28 days, that's what they defined as persistent post-concussion symptom. For the high risk, the specificity or the percent of true negatives was 93, and the sensitivity true positives was 20%.
So one of the things that I wonder is, is this clinical prediction rule ready for real time? Do you think that we can deploy these in emergency departments today?
Well, so it was a very large cohort. They took numerous steps, the pilot step, then the derivation step, and the validation step. And they did find that out of their, you know, cohort, they had 33, which matches the about 35% of patients that are pediatric patients that do experience ongoing somatic cognitive. So it does kind of match up with the general population. However, you know, on the sideline, are we going to know all of these symptoms right away? You know, a pediatric patient, you know, that is in the pediatric patient, they started at 5 years old. So the patients were between 5 and 17. The mean age was about 12. So if you asked a, you know, 6 or 7 year old if they had, you know, migraines or sensitivity to light, yeah, I think that might be a little difficult right away. I think after you talk with the parents and after a couple of days, I think you might be able to get a better understanding whether or not they have these risk factors and whether or not they are going to have the, be at risk for this persistent post-concussion symptoms. But I think that it is important to look at because, you know, this is certainly a population that does not have consistent medical care at these games. And I'm focusing on a, you know, a more traditional sports-related concussion, you know, those that go to the emergency room after a car accident or an assault or a fall. Those are serious mechanisms that have already been stamped with, you know, this is a serious problem, a serious mechanism. You have to take this seriously. However, concussions are still in the sports field are, you know, I feel like there's still a connotation of, you know, you can still continue to play, or where is that line between a bump in the head and I'm okay to this is a serious brain injury that needs to be cared for in a serious manner. So I feel like athletic trainers have a little bit more of a difficult time than those in the emergency department, you know, because we have to overcome this, you know, one, most sports-related concussions do not need to be seen in the emergency room. So having this clinical risk score can really help benefit educating these athletes like, yeah, you got to take it easy during recess. You know, if you want to get better, you're already at risk for prolonged recovery. I mean, explaining that to a 7-year-old, you know, is going to take some time and some wordsmithing. However, I think it's important for that 7-year-old to know that they do kind of have to take it easy and they are suffering from a, you know, a brain injury. And this is the steps and this is the precautions that they need to take to recover.
Great. So I think you brought up a few points there. One was the idea that this clinical risk score might be more applicable to emergency departments. So it's not clear that we can actually apply these yet in a more traditional on-field scenario or even immediately after the game in a sports medicine clinic. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yeah, I feel like this would, to really get a more true sideline for an athletic trainer to use this more on-field or athletic training clinic ready, the mechanism of injury really needs to be pared down to really only include sports-related injuries.
But you would also want to probably have a situation where they're testing the people in the environment that we're going to be testing. Because I think, as you pointed out, well, is the person that goes to the emergency room, it's a different time frame and it's a different environment that the person's being asked questions in.
Yeah, very, absolutely.
So one of the other things that you brought up was just deploying the clinical risk score and its usability. And one of the things that stood out to me in this post that you wrote up was that this risk score actually only does modestly better than just asking a physician if the person's likely to have persistent post-concussion symptoms. Isn't that right?
Yeah. When you're, you know, looking at the data, it really just scored, I think it was like a 0.61 where, you know, a 0.5 is a coin flip, so it's 50-50. The physician scored pretty close to that 50-50 mark, whereas the persistent post-concussion symptom score had about a 0.61 or a 0.68, where it was really not that much farther away from that, you know, 50-50 mark.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of times for these predictive models, we often want to look for something that's closer to a 0.75, if not even greater than a 0.8, to really be useful in a clinical setting. So it sounds like the investigators still have a little bit of room to adjust this. And maybe one of the things they need to do, as you suggested, is to identify more homogenous groups of people based on how they got their concussion.
I think that that would be one good step to take to really define, you know, concussion or 'cause who's going to need to use this score? You know, if athletic trainers need to use this score or nurses in the schools need to be able to see this score or, you know, policymakers for Return to Learn are going to need to use this score. It needs to be something a little bit more related to what they're going to see on a more common scale, you know, sports-related concussions.
Which is interesting, because I think earlier you talked about how we could use this potentially to help educate the patients, but this clinical risk score is a little bit different than some of the other clinical prediction rules we might think about in our clinical practice. You know, before we got on for recording, we talked about the idea that the Ottawa ankle rule is something that has a significant impact on how we do things in the clinic. It tells us whether or not we really need to be referring a person for x-ray because they might be high risk or low risk or a fracture. Versus here, it doesn't seem like beyond the education and making people aware, it might, at least for now, have an immediate impact on how we would actually do stuff, because we're still going to be monitoring each patient on a case-by-case thing to see how their symptoms resolve. Is there anything other use that you think we could use these risk scores for at this point? Or if it got better?
I feel like if it got better, we might be able to use the clinical risk score to determine maybe patient outcomes or helping patients with coping skills and coping mechanisms. So if somebody is going to be in the high risk group, you know, we might need to educate them on, you know, what are some ways to still identify yourself as an athlete or still hang out with, you know, your friends on the recess field or after school. You know, you don't want to, it's very difficult to try and tell a 9-year-old, no, you can't go play kickball during recess. You have to not participate or hang by the sideline. So I feel like that could be very helpful in implementing, you know, a more well-rounded evidence-based practice by implementing, you know, from a patient perspective, you know, how are they going to need to cope with this because they are in that high risk or even moderate risk group. So if you're going to be in the low risk, then, you know, maybe that doesn't have to be, you know, such a big part of that athletic trainer's, you know, job or that athletic trainer's role at that time to really help identify how this, you know, pediatric patient should be dealing with the injury. However, if they're in the moderate or high risk, maybe an extra step that athletic trainer can take, other than the normal management and monitoring, could be helping them identify some, you know, some good positive coping mechanisms. So they are progressing in a manner where they're not going to get anxious or suffer depression type symptoms that could end up prolonging concussion as well.
Great. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
No, one other thing. I just want to point out that, you know, with a little bit of some further research, I really like the readability and the ease of the score. I think that the variables that they included in the risk score are pertinent. None of these risk factors, you know, blast out at me like, oh my gosh, this is new and novel. These are all fairly common, and these have all been researched and, you know, pointed out as a risk factor. So having them combined in this 9-point, again, very easy to implement and easy to read scale, 0 to 3 low, 10 to 12 high. I think, again, it could be very beneficial.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it would be something that, as they refine this, could become really clinically useful and easy to deploy. Thanks, Jane.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Don't forget that we also share extra material on social media. And if you're an athletic trainer who's looking to get an early start with evidence-based practice CUs, then please check out our online courses available through the Human Kinetics website, and we have a link to these courses on our podcast webpage. Remember, you can always follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, or LinkedIn. We'll be back next week with Dr. Nicole Catano to discuss the cost-effectiveness of early ACL reconstructions. Until then, have a fun one.